You are listening to the 2014 M.J. Murdoch Charitable Trust Leadership Conference, Word Made Flesh, Leadership in a Modern World. In the fifth session, Sandra Richter provides a keynote address and Michael Lindsay offers a response.
Good morning, good morning. I don't know about you, but this is feeling a lot like an 8:30 class. The only difference is that none of you are in pajama pants. And I'm probably not going to have to walk up and down the front row gently tapping on your desk to help you stop nodding off. Oh, the skills of an undergraduate professor. All right, our title for today, An Image of Leadership, A Shepherd's Tale. Yesterday we talked about the question of leadership, the tale of two kings. Now we're going to focus in on a very critical metaphor to the biblical text and to the whole concept and question of leadership from a biblical perspective. So yesterday, in light of review, because I am a teacher, so I have to do the review thing. I just have to. There will be no exam, I promise. We talked about this critical question, whose kingdom is it anyway? And we rehearsed a very challenging story about leadership. We rehearsed a story that had point, counterpoint, hero, and foil, the juxtaposition of Saul and David in 1 Samuel. Why did David succeed where Saul failed? We learned yesterday that ultimately David succeeded because he never forgot who he worked for and whose kingdom he was actually building. David continued to recognize through all of his failings, and there were many of them, that he was not the true star on the stage. I think in so many ways, not only does that guard us against corruption and entitlement and all of the evils that come with power, but it also takes so much pressure off. This ultimately is not about me being perfect. This is about the kingdom of God. I'm in the wings. He's in the center. And so as the proverb says, David learned the lesson that a righteous person falls seven times, but dang it, he gets up eight. And this is the story of David and how he maintains his position of leadership. And so we learned that in the 10th century, the leadership gurus had much the same thing to say as the 21st century leadership gurus, that real authority is not structural, it's personal. And for the Christian leader, for David, the fact that he was a steward, the fact that he was a vassal, was more important than anything else on the table. So we're going to move from that, the remember who you work for theme, to our new question, this image of leadership. Now, all of us know that Psalm 23 has a passage that reads, "The Lord is my shepherd." All of us know that Jesus picks this up and claims to be the good shepherd. And most of us know that Philip Keller has written a killer devotional about sheep and shepherds. We know these things, but do any of us really know why this image frequents our faith lives? Well, one reason is because pastoralism, the task of raising sheep and goats, was as old as the proverbial hills in the ancient Near East. And as a result, the concept of shepherd as leader was already ancient, long before Abraham the shepherd or Moses the shepherd stepped onto the scene. Take George Adam Smith, for example. He's a Scottish theologian, and that's how many people know him, but he was also one of the very earliest historical geographers. And George Adam Smith took a canteen and a journal and rode horseback all over the land of pre-World War I Palestine and explored the historical geography of the biblical story over 100 years ago. And in those days when travel was anything but tame, he encountered the standard occupation of ancient Palestine. And that standard occupation was, you guessed it, that of a shepherd. Hear this quote. "On some high moor, across which at night hyenas howl, when you meet him, sleepless, far-sighted, weather-beaten, armed, leaning on his staff and looking out over his scattered sheep, every one on his heart, you understand why the shepherd of Judea sprang to the front in his people's history. why they gave his name to their king and made him the symbol of providence, why Christ took him as the type of self-sacrifice. George Adam Smith, 1856. But perhaps even more interesting than George Adam Smith is the fact that this image of shepherd as leader, as shepherd as king, goes another 2-3 millennia back. What you're looking at right here on the left is an image of Pharaoh Senseret. He dates to about 2500, actually he dates to about 1200 BCE, and in his hand he holds what? A shepherd's staff. Now, do we actually think the Pharaoh of Egypt ever kept sheep? The answer would be not just no, but heck no. But that staff in his hand actually becomes the hieroglyphic symbol in the Egyptian language for leader. So these folks in 1200 BC in Egypt realized the shepherd is a leader. To the right, you're looking at a very famous stela. It's a victory stela, a statue of an Akkadian king, Naram-Sin. He dates to about 2500. And in the stela, it's quite famous because Naram-Sin is actually elevating himself to deity. You see that his men are below him and the symbol of the god is above. Well, it's not the image of Naram-Sin that strikes us here because he's in battle. It's the words engraved on the stela, in which Naram-Sin is named the shepherd of Naram, the shepherd, comma, Naram-Sin. Naram-Sin is imitating his god, who is named Enlil, who is the god of kingship and hands kingship to the people. And what does Enlil choose to name himself? He is the shepherd of the black-headed people. So the Israelites didn't think up this image. They didn't think up the idea of shepherd as leader. Rather, they adopted it. So what do we know about shepherding in the ancient Near East? Well, one of the odder things you will learn about me is that one of my areas of expertise is the economy of ancient Israel. Yes, I know, it's a thrilling thing to put on my resume. I just came from the Society of Biblical Literature down in San Diego, where I presented a paper on an economic overview of the Iron Age and how we can date the book of Deuteronomy based on its economic presuppositions. If you would like to hear more about that, we got Q&A going. Okay, well, a essential aspect of the economy of ancient Israel are these two creatures. Now, these are show animals, so they're way prettier than you would normally see. But what you're looking at is a fat-tailed Owasi sheep and a black Sinai goat. I can assure you, with far more detail than you would ever want to know, that the keeping of these creatures in Israelite history was, again, as old as the hills. From the nomadism in the wilderness, where sheep and goats were their primary source of food and textiles, their primary source of clothing, to the days of agricultural settlement, when sheep and goats became one of several sources for their subsistence lifestyle, this black Sinai goat and fat-tailed Owasi sheep are going to be regular characters in the family. What sorts of flocks did the ancient keep? Well, they kept mixed flocks. In fact, they only have one word for the mixture of goat and sheep in a flock. Mixed flocks with kind of a 40-60 mix, 40% being the goats, 60 being the sheep. What are the fat-tailed Owasi sheep known for? They're known for their succulent meat and their excellent fleece. And we've got texts all over the ancient Near East about people trading and selling that fleece. They're also known for their milk. What about the goat? Well, you would never use a black Sinai goat's hair for clothes, not unless you were a monk and very interested in self-flagellation. It's very itchy, but you would use it for a tent or for some sort of storage container. You'd also eat these guys when they got old, but primarily you would milk them. So you might ask, why a mixed flock? And the answer would be a diversified portfolio. You see, sheep are worth more, but they die easier. It's kind of like, you know, the stock market going here. Whereas the Sinai goat, like the camel, has an extremely high resistance to the very rugged terrain and drought-susceptible wilderness that Israel inhabited. Those critters can drink 35% of their body weight in water in a few minutes, and you only have to water them once every 4 days. That's pretty impressive. Whereas, again, our sheep are much more fragile. The other reason we keep goats in the flock is because they're smart, and sheep are not. Sheep are dumb. A sheep will stand there and die a horrible death if an attacker faces them down. I was having a lovely conversation with the Weyerhausers earlier this weekend about their sheep and the wild German shepherd that broke into their yard and created a sheep slaughter right there in front of their eyes. Yeah, this is what sheep do. They stand there and say, please don't kill me. Their only natural defense is to huddle. If you've ever been involved in an institutional crisis, you've seen this, haven't you? The only thing sheep can do is huddle around an obscure, unimportant topic while the house is burning down. I know none of you have seen this. This is sheep. They huddle. A herd of sheep will walk right over the edge of a wadi and plunge to their death. Goats won't. So the goats are in the mix partly to keep the sheep alive. All right, so what do these flocks require? Well, movement constantly. It takes a tremendous amount of effort to continue to supply these mixed flocks with the pasturage they need. A transhuman lifestyle is what we call it, that forever keeps the shepherds on the move. And because the families are also agriculturalists, they have to farm, so they will send their flocks off with the least valuable member of their household, which would often be their youngest son. A child of 7, 10, 12 could be responsible for as many as 200 animals. If the flocks are larger, you'll be sending adult men off. If you remember the story of Joseph, the reason he goes to find his brothers near Dothan is because they've taken the flock north based on seasonal pasturage. These flocks can number in the thousands. What will caring for these animals in the wilderness involve? Well, it's going to certainly involve defense from predators. It's going to involve birthing, which is often very physical on the part of the shepherd, treatment of injuries and diseases, which will involve water and oil being poured on injuries, gathering up the scattered, protecting against those who might try to break in and steal. It is completely obvious, based on the texts of your Bible, and I hope you will never read it quite the same way again, the laws, the narratives, the proverbs, the metaphors, that there, and the massive amounts of material culture coming out of archaeology, that these people kept flocks. And it's all over your text, all over your text. The problem is that we 21st century types can't read the images. It's a foreign language to us. But to every man, woman, and child in Israel, everyone knew what a good shepherd looked like, and everyone knew what a bad shepherd looked like. Now, I have a friend. His name is Tim Laniak. He is now a very big wig. He is the dean of the Gordon Conwell branch seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina. I knew him back in the day. We did our PhDs together, and we're both Gordon Conwell grads as well. Well, Tim decided that it was time for him to move out of his 21st century set of metaphors and move back into the biblical text. So he took an Albright grant and a full year sabbatical, and he went to live with the Bedouin from 2003 to 2004. With his pre-adolescent son Jesse and a notebook, this man went and slept in Bedouin tents for a full year. And in that process, he interviewed every Bedouin shepherd that was willing to talk to him. What did he learn? Well, the first thing he learned is that the wilderness where sheep are kept is a very rugged place. Sheep die. In the horrible drought of the 1950s and 60s, it went on for 8 years, tens of thousands of animals dropped dead in front of their shepherd's eyes, and there was nothing the shepherds could do about it. They still speak of that drought to this day. What else did he learn? Well, one older Bedouin shepherd looked him in the eye and said, the key to being a shepherd is that you must have a heart for it. The elderly Bedouin shepherd said, my sons, they don't have the heart for it. But you, Professor Laniak, I think you have the heart. He actually tried to sell Tim his flocks and marry his son to one of his daughters. They said there is no curriculum, these shepherds. There's no curriculum for learning to be a shepherd. Rather, it's a long-term apprenticeship. Tim learned that water is critical and difficult to find, and any leader worth his salt will spend a good 50% of his time making sure that his flock can find water that is protected and defended. Adequate pasturage requires relentless effort, and a good shepherd is always on the move. He found out that shepherds are midwives. And again, in a very physical fashion, a shepherd will be delivering lambs, literally putting their hands and arms inside a delivering sheep to turn a lamb, to make sure that the lamb is born without trauma and the ewe survives without trauma. And if the birthing comes at the wrong time or too many ewes give birth at once, that shepherd doesn't sleep for days and is carrying lambs down off the hillside. He found out that sheep, as we have predicted, are not smart. He found out that sheep regularly get lost and panic. He told a lovely little story about a fellow named Saeed from the South Sinai. Saeed was 7 years old, and his task in the family was to keep a small group of 30 goats alive in the South Sinai, and his father would send him out every day with his little flock of 30 goats. Well, one day, Saeed came home with a goat missing. Now, I, for one, looking at a group of 30 goats, might not immediately be able to recognize that there is a goat missing, but Saeed's father had no hesitation. Saeed apparently had been flirting with a little shepherd girl who was out on the same hillside. And so, according to Tim's story, the father took one look at his son, locked him by the eyes, and said, "Go back out and don't come home without it." And so he sent his 7-year-old out into the wilderness for 2 days and 2 nights to find this goat. To me, this seems a bit harsh, especially when I hear the rest of the story, which is the fact that the goat was not only smarter than the sheep, he was smarter than Saeed. And so the goat came home all by himself the next morning. Did the father go out after his son? No, he didn't. He waited till Saeed came home, exhausted, thirsty, frightened of what discipline he would receive, and according to Laniac, there were no apologies. In fact, this apparently is the way, the traditional way, that the Bedouin train their children to take responsibility for the family's flock. What was that Washington internship thing? I can see this in the works. So a child learns from the tender age of 7 or 8 that the life of the flock is as important as his own, and good shepherds don't lose sheep. So as we return to the story, oh, by the way, here is Tim's book. This would be a wonderful sample book. You should make Terry get it for you. Let me read you one little quotation here. "My mother, a hill farmer of consummate skill, is still amazed at the variety of ways a sheep can find to die. Even the hardy Welsh mountain breed, which I was brought up with, are susceptible to braxy, pulpy kidney, staggers, pneumonia, pasturella, twin lamb disease, cancer, hypothermia in the winter, maggots in the summer, scab, scrappy, foxes, crows, and dogs. They push their heads through fences and get stuck. They climb trees to pick at foliage and get hung up by their horns or legs. They fall down banks. They get bitten by snakes and stung by wasps. They tumble into ponds and streams. They gorge themselves on fallen ash leaves. They roll on their backs. They blow up like balloons. They poison themselves on ragwort. Ram's horns regularly grow into their own heads. They starve, they freeze, they get depressed and fall ill. But a good shepherd can counter every affliction." All right, so let's move on to David. Oh, last thing. Tim learned that shepherds do indeed call their sheep by name, and sheep indeed do respond. One lost sheep is a tragedy that must be corrected. So as we return to the story of David, we find that the image of sheep and shepherd continues to track through his life. In 2 Samuel 7, when David starts getting a little too big for his britches, deciding that he will build a magnificent temple for Yahweh, and Yahweh says, hey, David, when I want a temple, I'll ask you one for it, okay? He says to David in this story, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, to be ruler over my people Israel. Just because you've succeeded doesn't mean you are no longer under my authority. In 2 Samuel chapter 12, we cited the story yesterday when Nathan shows up in the midst of David's sin and needs to get David to hear his crime. What parable does he use? But the parable of a ewe lamb, the most fragile and defenseless of a shepherd's flock. The story goes like this. Nathan stands in front of David and says, O king, I have a case for you, which would be a standard practice of a king to judge a case in court. Nathan goes on. He says, there were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a great many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which had grown up together with him and his children. It would eat and drink from his hand. It was like a daughter to him. But a traveler came to the rich man who had countless herds and flocks. And instead of taking one of his own ewe lambs, he took the poor man's and prepared it for the man who had come to him. Now, David does not know that this is a parable. David thinks this is a real case in court. And so David stands up and raged. It says in the Bible that David's anger burned greatly against the man. Why? Because David had been a shepherd. He knew what that poor man was experiencing. And so David demanded death, which as an expert in Deuteronomic law, I can tell you is way over the top. He demanded the man's death and recompense fourfold because David had compassion. David had empathy. David felt the man's pain. And Nathan turned to him in one of the prosecutorial moments of brilliance and said, "You are the man." In Psalm 78, when David has managed to move through his experience of leadership successfully, again, falling seven times but getting up eight, when the psalmist wants to speak of David's leadership, he summarizes it as follows. He also chose David his servant, and he took him from the sheepfolds, from the care of ewes with suckling lambs. He brought him to shepherd Jacob, his people, and Israel, his inheritance. So he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart, and he guided them with skillful hands. David ultimately is characterized as a good shepherd. All right, let's move this story forward. My handy-dandy timeline. I have heard rumor that there are many of you who are coveting my handy-dandy timeline. I want to inform you that the book that you will receive in an hour or two will have my handy-dandy timeline in it. And if you take the additional risk and pick up the DVD curriculum, you'll get multiple copies of my handy-dandy timeline. And if you email me, I will send you a digital version. Yes, I will. Okay, so we move forward from David, our paradigmatic king. I told you yesterday that every king who ruled after the time of David will be compared for good or for evil to David. He was the template. His dedication to the task was the bar to which all the others were held. And as you know, most of those who followed failed. There were periodic bright spots. Hezekiah and Josiah are two of those bright spots. But generally, the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah are characterized as false shepherds. Like Saul, their concerns were with their own success, their own comfort. The kingdom they were building was not God's kingdom. It was their own. And when after decades of second chances, silenced prophets, and broken promises, at last the axe fell. And these are the words that Yahweh has for his leaders. Ezekiel 34, one of the last prophets of the monarchy, steps up to the plate. He looks at this history of failure and collapse, and he says to the leaders of Israel, woe to the shepherds of Israel. Our metaphor has not changed. Woe to the shepherds of Israel who only take care of themselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? You eat the curds. You clothe yourselves with the wool and you slaughter the choice animals. But you don't take care of the flock. You have not strengthened the weak. You haven't healed the sick or bound up the shattered. Have you ever seen an animal wandering around on a compound fracture? I'm afraid to say I have. It's the most pitiful sight in the world. You haven't bound up the shattered. How callous must you be to watch an animal wandering around on a broken limb and you turn a blind eye? You've not bound up the shattered. You've not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. When Yahweh needs to call the leadership of Israel on the carpet, when he needs to tell his kings, you have not succeeded in shepherding my flock, you are bad leaders because they've abused their authority, these are the words he speaks. He says, no, my people have been scattered because there was no shepherd. And when they were scattered, they became prey for all the wild animals. My sheep wandered all over the mountain on every high hill. They were scattered over the whole earth, and no one went out after to search for them. Why? Because the life of the flock was not worth more than the life of the shepherd. And the shepherd was not going to place himself at risk for the flock. I don't think Saeed's father would be happy with that scenario. Now, if you know your biblical history real well, you know that what Ezekiel is speaking of is the great watershed of the exile. In 586 BC, the final remnant of the nation of Israel collapses to the Babylonian Empire. This is the horrific moment when the curses of Mount Sinai are finally brought home to roost on God's people. They lose their land, they lose their homes, their flocks, their children, their lives. The closest parallel we have in modern history is the Holocaust. Because of their unending rebellion against their God, God finally says to Israel, enough. And the armies of the Babylonian Empire flood over the land promised to Abraham and drag off his descendants as slaves of another kingdom. Those whom Yahweh freed from slavery in Egypt, by Yahweh's own hand, become the slaves of the Babylonian Empire. And all of this heart-wrenching loss is blamed on the shepherds. You did not keep my flock. You thought it was yours. And we come right back around to yesterday's lesson. Whose kingdom is it anyway? This message of failed leadership that has scattered the flock is confirmed when we turn to the New Testament. Because Jesus' mission, when he arrives, is a mission that is defined and explained and illustrated over and over again as the mission of the Good Shepherd. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save what was lost. Indeed, when Jesus looks out over the crowds in Jerusalem, he is moved deeply for them because they were harassed and disheartened like sheep not having a shepherd. And when Jesus turns to his under-shepherds, the disciples, he says to them, go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Do you hear it? We still have the heart of a shepherd, a real shepherd, a good shepherd, who will not rest until he finds that one lost sheep and brings that one home, who will not allow the wolves to rip and tear at his flock, who realize, as Mark told us yesterday, that human beings inherently need to be led. When we turn to John chapter 10, Jesus repeatedly compares himself to a shepherd, and he compares his followers to sheep. I am the good shepherd, and the good shepherd lays down his life for his sheep. He tells his audience, my sheep hear my voice. I know them, and they follow me. And in the day that he must tell his disciples, the shepherd is going to be struck down, He says to them in Matthew 26, "You will all fall away because of me this night, for it's written, 'I will strike down the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered.'" Clearly, Jesus is capitalizing on this ancient image of leadership, and he's continuing to portray the people of God as sheep in need of a shepherd. Similar to what we studied yesterday, the flock that he speaks of ultimately belongs to the chief shepherd. But like the king in Israel, God has ordained that there will be under shepherds. And so we turn at last to the very last chapter of the Gospel of John. Now, in this last chapter, Jesus has died, he has risen, and he's having one final exchange with his under-shepherds. And whereas the Gospel of Matthew ends with this fabulous great commission to all of the under-shepherds, the Gospel of John ends with one great commission given to one man, Jesus' best friend, his closest friend, his confidant, Peter. Peter, who when push came to shove, scattered like sheep. Who when he was questioned by a slave girl in the courtyard of the palace, denied his Lord and ran like a child. How many of us, I'm going to bet all of us, can imagine the emotions in Peter's stomach when a leader fails? When he fails the flock, when he fails the loyalty, when he lets down his best friend. What's churning in Peter's stomach, even at this breakfast on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, when all the tragedy seems to be over, what's churning in his soul when he looks across that breakfast fire at his Lord and his Savior is still very raw and very painful. And Jesus turns to Peter when he had finished breakfast, and he spoke to Simon Peter, Simon's first name. And he says, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" And Peter said, and you know what's churning in his belly, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And Jesus says, "Then feed my lambs." Jesus said to Peter a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter said to him, "Lord, you know that I love you." And Jesus said, "Then shepherd my sheep." Jesus said a third time. Why does Jesus ask three times? Because he knows that Peter needs some healing here. Peter needs the chance three times to say yes when three times before he said no. And so he turns to him a third time and he says, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter was grieved because Jesus had asked a third time. And Peter said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." And Jesus says to Peter, "Feed my sheep." The shepherds of God's people, who were the kings of Israel, had failed them. Sheep need a shepherd. The kings failed to direct God's people where they should go, and they failed to direct God's people where they should not go. But the great shepherd never wavered. "Do you love me? Then feed my sheep." This is our calling as leaders within God's kingdom. Regardless of every other noise, every other demand, every other busyness that assaults us, this is our great and weighty calling. The enormous sacrifice, the enormous joy of being a shepherd. And I think of George Adam Smith's quote, "On some high moor, across which at night the hyenas howl, when you meet him or her, sleepless, far-sighted, weather-beaten, armed, leaning on his staff and looking out over his scattered sheep, every one of them is on his heart. You understand why the shepherd of Judea sprang to the front in his people's history, why they gave his name to their king and made him the symbol of providence. Why Christ took him as the type of self-sacrifice, and I would add to that why he chose to name us under shepherds. Do you love me? And take care of my sheep." and the final promise that comes in our great text and our great narrative for our futures is in that final day. Never again will they hunger. Never again will they thirst. The sun will not beat upon them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. We spoke many times yesterday about real Christian leadership being a reflection of the character of God on this planet. I believe that this is the point of the shepherd metaphor. The great shepherd loves his flock. They are indeed his flock. So if we are going to aspire to care for that flock, we must always keep forthright in our lives that this work with his people and his kingdom is his work. And I think when we do that, a very complex picture becomes less complex. So let me leave you with a benediction, O under-shepherds of the flock. Now may the God of peace, who brought you up from the dead, the great shepherd of the sheep, through the blood of the eternal covenant, even Jesus our Lord, equip you in every good thing to do his will, working in that which is pleasing in his sight through Jesus Christ, to whom be the glory forever and ever. Thanks so much.
Okay, Sandy, thank you so much. So go ahead, take 5 minutes at your table, give a quick response on all that she had just said, if you can get that done in 5 minutes, of course. And Michael, as soon as that's up, I'll tap you on the shoulder and you just come right on up.
So let me bring our conversations to a close for just a second and offer a couple of things that I think might resonate with what Sandy offered, which was a wonderful presentation. So a number of people were asking me last night how it was that I was able to get some of these interviews, gotten a chance to meet some amazing people, and how was it that I was able to connect with them. Sometimes it's a matter of being in the right place at the right time. One of my favorite stories is I was out in Silicon Valley and had some time to kill, so I went to the bookstore at Stanford. And I'd been in the store for a couple of minutes, and look out of the corner of my eye and see a woman who looked exactly like Karen Hughes. Now, Karen Hughes was serving as counselor to the president, the highest ranking presidential appointment for a woman at that time in the White House infrastructure. And I knew she was a committed Christian, active in her Presbyterian church in Austin. And here she was in the flesh, or so I thought. And so I thought, this is my big break. I wasn't positive it was Karen Hughes because there was no entourage and she was wearing blue jeans. So I thought, I need to wait until she speaks because I'll recognize her voice. And so I just sort of eased up beside Karen Hughes while browsing my book. And after a couple of minutes, sure enough, I recognized this raspy Texan voice and said, this is my big break. This is Karen Hughes. And in that moment, I realized, you know, I've never asked somebody for an interview face-to-face. I'd sent them letters, emails, faxes, even telephone calls. But I never asked them, like, point blank. It's sort of like asking somebody out on a date face-to-face. What if they say no? Then it's socially awkward. So I need to sort of get my nerve up. So I decided, just going to sort of take some time. And so I sort of circled around Karen Hughes. And after I had made a full circle, I was still a little bit nervous. So I decided, I'm going to circle again a second time. And I just sort of made some concentric circles around Karen Hughes. I actually circled around Karen Hughes 5 times in the Stanford bookstore. At the end of the 5th cycle, I decided, you know what, this is too stressful. And I walked out of the store. There's a large plaza outside the bookstore at Stanford, and I was standing there and thinking, now why was I so intimidated by her? So what if she says no? She'll forget it in 5 minutes, I'll remember it the rest of my life. So I decided, I'm gonna go back in. So I walk back into the bookstore, and I can't find her. And I thought, well, this is divine punishment. I didn't have the nerve to approach her, and now God's showing me, oh, ye of little faith. Eventually, I notice that she's on the 2nd floor at the coffee bar. So I start walking up the stairs, and as I'm walking up the stairs, I begin thinking, now how should I address her? Do I say Counselor Hughes or Madam Counselor, Mrs. Hughes, hey, Karen? You know, what am I supposed to say? I'm still having this conversation in my head when I reach her, so I just tap her on the shoulder. Now, when I get nervous, I have this habit of red splotches appearing on my neck. And the moment she turned around, I could feel the blood sort of rushing up to my head. I realized I have about 60 seconds before I will turn beet red. I said, Mrs. Hughes, my name is Michael Lindsay. I'm a sociologist working on a research project. Told her a little bit of what I was doing and asked if she'd be willing to give me an interview. She was very nice, and she said, I'm actually out here looking at colleges with my son, and so this is not the right time, but I'll give you my telephone number, and if you call me in a couple of months, I'd be happy to sit down with you. So I held on to that phone number, and a couple months later, I gave her a call. I said, Mrs. Hughes, this is Michael Lindsay. I don't know if you remember me. She said, oh, yes, the young man who turned bright red at Stanford. I said, yes, that's me. And she said, sure, I'd be happy to sit down with you. We ended up doing the interview at the Haight Ames Hotel, which is right across the street from the White House in Washington. And it was a great interview because here's a woman who had not really spent her entire life scheming and strategizing to get to the inner circle of political power. She was pretty much surprised that she found herself there. And once she got there, she had all these questions in her mind about, why am I here and what am I doing? I'm working these crazy hours. She had a teenage son and her husband who she never got a chance to see. She would leave the house before they would be up, and she would not get home until 8 or 9 o'clock at night and was working this relentless pace. And she began to say, you know, what is the purpose of my calling and what am I supposed to be doing? And she grappled with these very significant questions. And getting a chance to interview her, I was sort of able to get a window into that sort of self-critical self-reflection that a leader experiences. Listening to Sandy, I was struck by how much, when we think about leadership, we can become so self-absorbed. And maybe what we need to do is turn our thinking a little bit toward followership. Barbara Kellerman is at Harvard, and she's actually written a book on this subject, and has suggested that the most effective leaders are those who've been able to help us to think about different principles, to really focus on who are we serving. One of the key things I wanted to share with you, which would sort of be number 7 of those leadership principles, is that there is no dream team of one. Never is. We really rely upon the people that we serve to help build a thriving, developing institution. Institutions really matter. They matter more today than they probably ever have because we've become a culture that's dominated by large institutions. It's interesting because working with college students, they have this love-hate relationship toward institutions. They hate institutions. They hate big government. They hate big business because they see that as something, you know, not entrepreneurial, not something that's creative, and it's sort of stodgy and bureaucratic. Yet at the same time, they're hoping to create new ventures that will end up becoming thriving enterprises. What I remind them of is that they're actually interested in creating institutions. The very thing they disdain is what they're working to build. Institutions matter a great deal because it becomes the mechanism by which real cultural change occurs. Earlier this year, a man named George Heilmeier died. In his obituary published in the New York Times, it recounted his story of being the son of an immigrant couple who came to work at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia on the janitorial crew. Because Penn had a generous tuition remission program, even the janitor's kids would be able to go and study at Penn if they got in. And George was a good student. He was interested in science. And so he ended up matriculating at the University of Pennsylvania. While he was there, he became turned on to the idea of electrical engineering and ended up graduating from Penn and got a job working for RCA. While he was a junior engineer at RCA, George Heilmeier stumbled upon an amazing discovery. He and his research team that he led created in 1964 liquid crystal displays. He invented it. He then went to his boss to say, look at this amazing innovation which can change so much of what we think about, not just televisions, but all electronic devices could be radically changed with the way in which we reconfigure this lighting device. His manager wasn't that impressed. He didn't think it was going to be all that interesting and didn't have a lot of practical application. And so he sort of put it to the side. George got frustrated and ended up writing a letter to the CEO of RCA saying, this is a remarkable innovation we have come upon, and we need to patent this so that we can own it, because this is RCA's next big venture. The CEO listened to some of his colleagues and decided, you know what, this is an exciting young man, but I don't think we're really that interested in it. And as a result, RCA never filed the patent on liquid crystal display. Meanwhile, the idea began percolating because George had been talking to a number of people, and there was a Japanese firm that became interested in it, Sony. And they are the ones who actually brought liquid crystal display to the market. George Heilmeier created liquid crystal displays, but because he could not get his institution to back him, to bring it to the marketplace, it never got the wide attention that was worthy of his true innovation. There is no dream team of one. Another thing that struck me as I was listening to Sandy is an idea that comes from John Cotter. John Cotter has said that management is primarily focused on managing complexity. Leadership is primarily focused on managing change. And many of us in our roles have to do both of those things. We have to both manage complexity and we have to manage change. And the reason why the person at the top has to deal with both of those things is because they have emotional components. When we're really paying attention to the sheep, when we're paying attention to our followers, we have to be mindful of the fact that their emotional state is not always the same place where we are in the process of managing complexity or managing change. When you are the leader of an organization or a team, It can be a group of five people or an organization of 50,000 employees. When you are in the process of that, the entire organization is riding what we might call a roller coaster of change. And the leader is in the front car. The leader is the person who sees the steep ascent that is we're about to enter into before anybody else does. And then the leader reaches the top, the pinnacle, the most exciting moment on the ride. The leader reaches that before anybody else does. In fact, the leader reaches it while other people are still climbing. And then the leader begins the descent and sees the downside while other people are just now reaching the summit. The great challenge of leadership is that you're in a different emotional place than your followers most of the time. You have to manage both complexity and change by paying attention not just to your own emotional state, but also the emotional state of those folks who are following. It's easy for us to sort of get frustrated and say, why are they not coming on board? Why don't they see the challenge? It's because they don't have all the information that you do. And so you're in a predicament where you've got to somehow manage not only your emotions, but also the emotions of others. Bill Clinton is probably the master of this. He has a remarkable ability to be able to manage emotions throughout the process. But actually, I learned that this is something that's required of all our presidents. Do you know what President Obama was doing the night that our special forces were seeking to capture Osama bin Laden? He was delivering the main address at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. This is the one night of the year where the President of the United States is expected to be the comedian in chief. So he's literally on the stage in Washington trying to entertain all of the journalists who would be dying to know actually what he knows is happening because he just came from the Situation Room. But you can't let on those kinds of issues. Bill Clinton found out the Lewinsky scandal was going to lead to his impeachment. He found out about that about 2 minutes before he went on national television for an interview. And he can't let that on. Part of the challenge of leadership is managing your emotions and realizing you're in a different place than the rest of the followers. The last thing I want to share about followership is how easy it is when you are the shepherd, so to speak, to be too focused on yourself and to lose sight of the really significant work that you're trying to do for your sheep. This is the most common temptation. Yesterday, I mentioned about Colin Powell and saying how the most natural response to people with power is to flaunt it. And the most common temptation of those of us in leadership is to want more of it. Jealousy. It's amazing how much we want to see the flock that the other guy has. It happens all the time. Why? In part is because those folks who are leading enterprises tend to be competitive, and they oftentimes are driven. But it's also common because the very environment in which we exist encourages coveting a lot. It's part of being in the mix of this fallen world. A lot of times I share stories of extraordinary people, but I'd like to close my thoughts this morning with a personal story. In 2007, I transformed my dissertation into what was a trade book that was published by Oxford University Press called Faith in the Halls of Power. And this was a really big deal for me. It was a project I had worked on for a number of years. And as it turned out, OUP was the perfect publisher for this project, and they were very excited about it. In fact, it was their lead title for that year. And it got a lot of wonderful attention, much more attention than it possibly deserved. And I went on a book tour and was talking about it and had some amazing experiences as part of that. One of my good friends is Andy Crouch, and Andy's a writer as well. And about 2 weeks before I went on my book tour, Andy said, Michael, there's this cool new device that Amazon has where you can actually track your daily sales of your book. And he said, it's really cool because, you know, the bestseller list, you have to wait and it's a long delay. This is like real time. Who's interested? And he said, so you can actually see when you travel to Portland and you give a talk at Powell's Books, you can actually see, you know, what kind of response did it generate and were people really excited about this? And he said, even better is that you can also track your performance against another book that sort of is in the same genre. And so you can sort of see how you're going. I thought, well, this sounds really interesting. So I began talking to my editor about this and the publicist, and they were getting all excited about that. We were trying to decide what would be another book that would probably be a good one to sort of compare, you know, how this book was doing. Well, as it turned out, about a week before my book was released, there was another book that came out that was looking at power in America. It was based upon about 250 interviews that the writer had done, and it was also a trade book. It was called The Nine. It was written by Jeff Toobin, where he had interviewed all these people who had been clerks to the 9 Supreme Court justices. And it was a wonderful book, and it was getting some good attention, and it had just come out. And so I decided that's the book that I'm going to sort of measure against. Now, someone should have said to me, you know, Jeff Toobin is a senior editor at The New Yorker, and so he's got a higher profile than you do, Michael Lindsay. And he's also on CNN 3 times a week. And he also has written a lot of best-selling books. And so maybe you want to sort of think about who are you hitching your wagon to. But no, I was just so excited about the idea that this was a way for me to track my performance. And so on day one, I'm happy to report, Faith in the Halls of Power was neck and neck with The Nine. And on day two, we were holding steady. On day three, he did a little bit better. And I was trying to figure out what happened. Well, he got reviewed in an outlet, and so, oh, well, that must be the explanation. But we had a review for my book coming out, and so on day four, I expected sort of the bump, and actually, he went a little bit better, and I just did slightly better. And then day five, I started sort of noticing there was a little bit of a trend line where he was beginning to separate from me, and that started to bother me. So I started talking with our publicist, what could we do? What was Jeff Toobin doing that we were not doing? Who were they talking to? How could we make these connections? And we began sort of strategizing, and I would say that after about a week of this, pretty much the marketing strategy for my book became, how can we duplicate what Jeff Toobin was doing for The Nine? I became pretty much obsessed with Jeff Toobin. I began to study the words that he would use in interviews. I was checking out sort of his body language. I was figuring out who is he cozying up to that was getting him all these great reviews, and I was really pretty much infatuated with this man and with his book. Now, meanwhile, Faith in the Halls of Power was doing wildly better than it ever should have. And you would think that in that moment, I would just sort of be able to say, thanks be to God. You know, finally, I actually wrote a book that my grandmother wants to read. But instead, I became obsessed with The Sheep on His Hill. It turned out Jeff Toobin and I were both invited to give keynote addresses at the Texas Book Festival in Austin, Texas. You would have thought that this is a, you know, sort of our big moment. We were going to go on at the same time. You would have thought, I finally feel like I have arrived. I'm now equal with Jeff Toobin. No, instead, I paid attention to the fact that he was speaking in the House chamber when I was speaking in the Senate chamber. The House chamber was 3 times larger than the Senate chamber. I still could not get over just sort of being so envious of the attention he was getting. I got on the plane to fly back to Houston, and had been in my seat for just a couple minutes, and I look up, and there is Jeff Toobin getting on my plane. And he comes, and he sits down on the seat right in front of me. The energy in the room was so amazing. I thought, this is the moment. I want to say some real zinger to this guy. I mean, I'm sort of working up what I'm going to say. And I so much want him to be a jerk, I have to say. And then he sort of stands up and he helps this little old lady put her suitcase up. And I think, well, that makes me mad. Hate you all the worse. Eventually, I just said I'm going to speak to him. So I just sort of tap him on the shoulder and I said, Jeff, hey, Michael Lindsay. Thinking he recognized me, he didn't. I say, you know, we were both doing at the Texas Book Festival. How'd your talk go? And we sort of talked about that. And after a couple of minutes, I kind of liked this guy. And in this conversation, I'm beginning to think, you cannot like this guy. This guy has been ruining your life for 2 months. And there's sort of this transcendent moment while I'm having this conversation with Jeff Toobin. And I begin to realize that my life had become so absorbed with coveting what this guy had. I would never have thought that I was a person taken to jealousy. Never. But it was when I first tasted the fruit of success that I became addicted in some ways. And it was like a drug that I wanted more and more of. I share that story just to simply say it is so easy to allow, frankly, gifts that come from God to be turned into idols. And I saw it in my own life. Part of the message that we receive from the Good Shepherd, and when he tells us to shepherd my sheep, is that it's a reminder, it's not about us. Unto him much is given, much is required. Shepherd my sheep.